Thanks very much, Tamara, and thank you so much for the invitation to speak to you again. It's a pleasure to be back at this conference. I last spoke to CPA Australia in Brisbane 2 years ago, and so it was a real treat to be asked back. When I last spoke to the group 2 years ago, I noted it had already been 3 years since interbank markets had become disrupted. And already then, 2 years ago, we'd seen the after effects in places like Greece that had had nothing to do with the origins of the crisis. So we've been coping with some level of financial crisis globally and distress for 5 years now. So what I'd like to do today is take a step back and consider the beginnings of the crisis. I'd like to discuss why neither its genesis nor its propagation to the global financial system were anticipated and why it was not prevented. And I'd like to set out some of the lessons to take from this crisis, including some mistaken conclusions that should not be taken on board. So before the crisis, global financial conditions could be best described as too good to be true, and we knew it. Looking back at some of the financial stability reviews that we published in 2006 or 2007, and looking at some of those published by foreign agencies as well, it's pretty clear that we knew all was not well. It was a bit like those horror movies where someone says, it's a bit quiet, isn't it? And we were the ones saying, yeah, a little bit too quiet. Investors were accepting very low prices for taking on risk. You can see this here in bond spreads, which were very low in that 06-07 period. Credit growth was also very strong in quite a number of countries. Now, prior to August 2007, there were some early shudders, or false starts, if you like, that caught a lot of people's attention. We saw the wobble of an exchange rate here or the collapse of a hedge fund there. And I remember sitting in meetings at the BIS in early 2007 talking about some of these events. And the question on everybody's lips was, is this the big one? So a lot of people in policy circles and elsewhere were alert to the vulnerabilities in the system. Lots of people knew that there was a chance something could go seriously wrong. But nobody, no matter what they claim now, really anticipated quite how it would play out. A lot of people were aware that the risks in the US mortgage market had risen, but few realised it had reached the point that it was no longer a housing boom of the kind that we'd seen before. Some people were aware that lending standards had eased, but few appreciated just how far things had gone in the United States. I know I didn't at the time. I wrote a paper in 2006 that pointed out that not all housing booms result in macroeconomic busts, although they can worsen downturns that happen for other reasons. And now that conclusion remains true. Not all booms end in crisis, even though the US one did. And what I said there was a pretty good prediction for the countries that I actually mentioned in the passage in that paper, which was Australia, the UK, and the Netherlands. But it would have been a terrible forecast for outcomes in the United States, which is a country I wasn't actually referring to in that section. Foreign observers, like the Reserve Bank, just didn't realise how overstretched the US housing market had become, because there simply wasn't the data to show that lending standards had eased more in the US than in other countries. The US authorities and most other observers in the United States largely missed it too. They weren't routinely comparing their situation with other countries, and they didn't see how exceptional it had become. Now, to be sure, some private commentators were concerned about the US housing bubble. But the metrics that they cited were things like the ratios of housing prices to incomes or to rents. And these metrics would not have told you that the US housing market was in a more vulnerable position than those of other countries. Prices and debt had actually risen less in the United States than in several other countries where the booms have ended much less painfully. The poor lending practices that created so many bad loans in the United States simply weren't sufficiently visible in the data. Most of the activity was in new non-bank lenders that didn't attract much scrutiny from regulators. And some banks didn't even seem to recognise that they were easing up on lending standards. And you can see that in this graph. This is a graph that summarises surveys from of senior loan officers at banks, and it says, you know, it asks them, are you tightening lending standards or are you easing them? And then it takes the net balance. And so this is what they told the survey takers at the Fed about their mortgage lending standards and whether they were, you know, whether more of them were easing than tightening or vice versa. And as you can see from the orange line, right up until everything fell apart in 2007, they weren't reporting easing lending standards. They knew that they were tightening in 07 and 08, but they did not report much easing before that. Look, they didn't see it as easing. In their eyes, they were just responding to competition. Now, housing prices had only fallen around 5% in the US by mid-2007, but already this was enough to put several lenders out of business. Because they securitised their loans, they didn't think they needed to absorb losses, and so they didn't have balance sheets to absorb losses. They were volume businesses. But when the loan went bad so quickly that it obviously should never have been granted, contractually, the investors in the resulting mortgage-backed security could put back the loan to the originator. There was a shockingly large number of these early defaults. Now, property busts, especially commercial property, but sometimes also housing, often spark domestic banking crises. If the US had had a banking crisis all on its own, as it did with the S&L crisis in the early 1990s, perhaps that crisis could have been dealt with differently if it was like that other one. But this crisis went global, and it was this connection between the US mortgage market and the global financial system that wasn't well understood and that essentially nobody predicted. So how did that happen? A couple of things caused that. First, some of the central actors in the US mortgage finance boom were a few dozen global banks. They were heavily connected with the global banks headquartered elsewhere. They were the centre of the global financial system. Second, the securities that were backed by these mortgages were in some cases bought by foreign banks or their affiliates. So instead of sweeping the risk from these loans out of the banking system, securitisation spread some of the losses through the banking system. A third factor that helped turn this local housing bust into a global panic was that the resulting securities were long-term assets, but they were funded by very short-term funding. Now, maturity transformation, borrowing short and lending long, is a normal function of the banking system. It's also an important reason why banking institutions have to be prudentially regulated. They have to hold capital, they have to hold liquidity in order to avert a run, and they have to be able to access central bank liquidity in the event of a general panic beyond themselves. But in the US, the banking system wasn't the main provider of mortgage credit. There were all these mortgage brokers that then were packaging up the loans and sending them up into the securitisation chain. Those loans were packaged into securities and then often passed from bank to bank in a complex production chain, tranching and retranching, before landing in a balance sheet of an ultimate investor or investment vehicle. And often those investment vehicles were themselves funded very short term. Investors were using these vehicles for transactional purposes, like funding their payroll, expecting the funds to be liquid, just like a bank account, but without a proper liquidity backstop, like a bank account. One thing that policymakers didn't expect is that the professional investors in these kinds of funds were even more flighty and prone to panic and to run than retail depositors. Now, As I mentioned, there were only a few dozen institutions involved in running the securitisation machine. There were, however, many more ultimate investors in the final securities, even local governments here in Australia. Often those ultimate investors did not understand the risks in those securities. The structures were quite opaque, and the language describing the underlying mortgages, subprime, Alt-A, HELOC, and so on, HELOC stands for Home Equity Line of Credit, by the way, all of those labels just don't give a good sense of the quality of the loans. The same label was applied to loans that performed very differently depending on who made the loan and where the home was, just to take a few examples. So as the mortgage losses piled up, the prices of these securities fell. The firms and the investment vehicles that held those securities began to incur losses. The consequences of this were another thing that policymakers did not anticipate. Not only did they not appreciate how exposed the major global banks and some minor ones were to these bad assets, they also, quite understandably, didn't appreciate how much everyone would panic because they didn't know which of their counterparties were exposed to the bad assets and how far the prices of those securities would decline. So banks became unwilling to lend to each other on an unsecured basis. And as you can see in this chart, the price of such lending rose dramatically, particularly in the US, the UK and Europe, less so in Australia. So securitisation was meant to be this wonderful thing that got risk out of the banking system, but actually it just moved most of it to other parts of the banking system, out of sight of the US regulators, and apparently out of mind of the bank's management. Since I'm speaking to an audience of accountants, I should also mention the role that valuation practices played in the crisis. Because these securities were so opaque, investors were unusually uncertain about how they should be priced. Sometimes they just relied on the credit rating, which creates its own problems. Sometimes they relied on the pricing models of the banks that sold them the securities, which is a huge governance issue. But even if they did their own valuations, marking to model became all but infeasible. It wasn't enough just to disclose what kinds of mortgages were behind the security, because the marketing labels didn't reveal enough about loan quality. There was subprime and there was subprime. The level of detail about the lending standards mattered enormously, and so did the details of the valuation models based on that information. So after the panic that followed the failure of AIG, Lehman and others, it wasn't long before the macroeconomic data, took a turn for the worse. The global economy headed for a serious downturn. As you can see in the green bars on the left-hand side of this graph, the contraction in the G7 economies was unlike anything anyone had seen in decades. So why did economic activity contract so quickly? And in so many countries that were quite removed from the financial centres where the trouble began? I don't think there is yet a definitive answer to this question. There are several plausible possibilities, but two in particular come to mind. The first is that there was a huge news effect. Remember, it wasn't just Lehman Brothers that failed in those critical weeks. There'd been a cascade of failures, especially in the US. Just to give you a personal anecdote, I was actually on holiday visiting a friend in Berlin just before I came back to this job, to start this job in the October. And the weekend that Lehman Brothers failed, I got a text message from a friend back in Australia that said, "Lehman failed, BOA buys Merrill Lynch. Best of luck with your new job, you'll need it." So there was a real sense that the global financial system was at risk of collapse. It's understandable that many households and firms saw that news and decided to rein in their spending to protect themselves better from the coming downturn. And in doing so, they helped create that downturn. Keynes's animal spirits remain highly relevant to macroeconomic outcomes, even now. Second, and reinforcing that effect, there's some recent empirical work that's emphasised that a few large organisations can actually have a disproportionate effect on economic activity. So effects that are specific to an individual firm don't just wash out in the aggregate. For example, this research cites evidence that 35% of Korean exports is accounted for by just two firms. And only 10 or so firms account for the same fraction of Japanese exports. With that in mind, it isn't hard to imagine how these large reactions occurred in apparently distant countries. If both those Korean firms changed their production plans because of concerns stemming from the crisis, even if everyone else felt fine, of course we would see large effects in the macroeconomic data. In that light, perhaps, the sharp declines in real output during this period can be more easily understood, even if they seem shocking at the time. Just to give you some perspective, this is Japan. The first big dip is the financial crisis. The second, much smaller dip, is the earthquake last year. And you can see how much more quickly they recovered from the earthquake than they did from the financial crisis. So you had a very substantial decline. Even though Japanese banks weren't really involved in buying these securities, even though, you know, Japanese households weren't the ones with the subprime loans, you saw this enormous decline in industrial production that took a long time to recover from. And that's what I'm talking about, is that everybody pulled their horns in, and it really mattered that you've got this very concentrated kind of industrial structure. And as economies turned down and risk aversion rose, we started to see the effects, including in parts of the world that apparently were unconnected to the original crisis. Business models that seemed to work when credit was easy started looking less sensible. We're seeing that especially clearly in Europe recently. But there have been several other waves of turmoil in between, in places like Dubai and Eastern Europe. So the last 5 years have taught a number of lessons to policymakers and market participants and outside observers in places like academia. But have we learned the right lessons? Well, we learned that short-term wholesale funding markets can be even flightier than supposedly unsophisticated depositors. So banks needed to change their funding mix, and in Australia, they largely have done. But the firms overseas that got into trouble because of their funding models tended to have much higher shares of wholesale funding and shorter maturities than we see in Australia today. It'd be a mistake to conclude that any level of wholesale funding is dangerous. We should also bear in mind that some of the metrics people use to assess funding structures can be quite misleading. I'm thinking particularly of the loan-to-deposit ratio. This ratio is higher in Australia than it is in some other countries. But it's not out of line with a few others. It's the blue bars on this graph. But if you see a bank with a very low level of this ratio, well below 100%, ask yourself what that bank is doing with the deposit funding instead. They're investing it in securities and other kinds of investment. And as we saw in the crisis, those securities can often be far riskier than regular lending. So it would be a mistake to focus on these kinds of metrics. We also had another iteration of the old lesson that property market dynamics can drive episodes of financial instability. 10 years ago, the global debate about whether monetary policy should respond to asset prices was rather unhelpfully focused on equity markets, which at the time did not have the kind of leverage that's the nub of the problem. The crisis has shown that property markets are usually more relevant to financial stability. These markets have the boom-bust dynamics and the leverage needed to turn an asset price downturn into a financial crisis. But it would be a mistake to conclude that the biggest, or indeed the only, risk to financial stability stems from home mortgage lending. Quite frankly, I consider it irresponsible to fixate on one source of risk to the exclusion of others that are more relevant or pressing. Let me be clear. Risks from housing are not zero, nor will they ever be. But commercial real estate and property developers are still more likely to pose risks to a financial system, and through it, to the real economy. The longer history of financial crises all over the world has taught us that. And there are other risks within the financial system itself that are at least as worthy of attention. Any sensible policy for promoting financial stability monitors all reasonable potential risks and responds proportionately according to their relative importance. It would likewise be a mistake to conclude that just because housing markets in some countries have caused problems, they always will in all countries. The US market is quite unusual. Housing booms have to end sometime, but they don't have to end in tears. Among other things, it takes the passage of time and diligent attention from regulators to ensure that housing booms don't end in harmful busts, but it can be done. We learned that the major banking systems of the world needed more capital, and that the capital needed to be real loss-absorbing capital. That's why the Basel III package was so crucial. But it would be a mistake to think that the answer to every problem is more capital. I can well imagine a situation where bank management and maybe even regulators become complacent about highly capitalised banks. They might think their bank can't possibly burn through all that capital and fail. Just like that ship can't possibly sink. If the same bank gets more capital but changes nothing else, it will be safer. There will be more shareholders' funds to absorb any losses that might occur. But all else is not equal. The bank with more capital might feel emboldened to grow faster or take on other risks. Or it might be being required to hold that extra capital because it has a business model that is inherently riskier in ways that the Basel risk weights don't capture properly. For example, its business might be particularly geographically concentrated. The Basel framework already handles cases like this in what's known as Pillar 2. Supervisors can and do require banks to hold more capital to cover these kind of bank-specific risks. In Australia, APRA routinely sets some institutions' prudential capital ratios to be higher than the Basel minimum. Business models differ, and thus so do inherent risks. Because of that, I wouldn't necessarily expect a bank with high capital to be safer than one with lower capital. It might be, or it might not be. It depends. It depends on whether the additional capital was enough to cover these less easily measured risks. So we shouldn't be surprised that banks with high reported capital ratios were not less likely to fail than banks with lower capital ratios. Part of the problem is that the rules differ slightly across countries, even under Basel II. Basel III is going to fix that to a great extent. Certainly, even where there are different rules, there'll be a whole bunch of disclosure to make sure that everyone can actually compare on an apples-to-apples basis. But more broadly, though, this is an example of the well-known trope that you become what you measure. If you tell people to fulfil a particular metric, they'll do so. But in doing so, the metric will start to lose its relationship with the thing that you really care about. In economics, this is known as Goodhart's law, but it's something that an awful lot of people are very, very aware of. So for this reason, I doubt that we will ever find a single metric or a single variable that will ensure financial stability if only banks could be made to meet it. That's why diligent supervision is, if anything, more important than how simple or complex or clever the rules might be. Finally, there was a further lesson reinforcing our existing view that the pursuit of financial stability requires thinking holistically. The people who knew that the US mortgage market had become imprudent didn't know how the resulting credit risk was being distributed globally. The people who understood structured finance didn't know much about housing and mortgage markets. The system was too complex and interconnected for one person to be expert in all of its elements and links. In fact, we shouldn't expect any complex system, whether the financial system or some other one, to be entirely within a single person's expertise. And this is why interagency cooperation and international cooperation and information sharing is so important. So to conclude, 5 years on, we're still in a world where risk aversion is high and some parts of the financial system globally seem dysfunctional. In some countries, though not Australia, I believe, the supply of credit is tighter than the underlying risks would require. I hope I won't come back in 5 years' time to deliver a speech titled 10 Years of Financial Crisis. But I do think that the experience of the past 5 years has affected a whole generation of financial market participants and policymakers. We'll never be able to regulate the financial boom-bust dynamic away entirely. There will always be people with the risk appetite and the incentives to become over-exuberant. It wouldn't surprise me, though, if the next 5 or 10 years sees a lot less of that over-exuberance than we saw in the 5 or 10 years leading up to 2007. The challenge will be to be ready to respond when those memories fade and the next generation of the overconfident are gearing up for a party. Thank you very much for your time.
John Thornton, the Ambulance Service of New South Wales. What role do you see that credit default swaps contributed to the global financial crisis? And part two, what role are credit default swaps playing now?
Thanks very much, John. Credit default swaps, I didn't get into them that much. I think there have been a lot of lessons around credit default swaps. They certainly didn't help. And they were quite... the main role they played was, of course, AIG. AIG had written a whole lot of credit default swaps, and that was one of the reasons they had the liquidity crunch that caused them to fail. So when you have concentrated exposures, they can turn out to be very difficult. I mean, essentially, you're writing an insurance contract on events that are quite correlated. It's not like, you know, I mean, in the ambulance service, you might appreciate this. It's not like sort of fire insurance and, you know, accident insurance where, I mean, in fire insurance, you know, everybody doesn't suddenly wake up one day and say, okay, I think I'm going to take up smoking in bed, which, of course, raises your risk of having a house fire. You don't have that kind of correlation. But in insuring credit, you absolutely do have this correlation. When things get bad, everyone defaults at once. And I think that correlation hadn't been fully appreciated, certainly by AIG's management. And so the fact that these, you know, someone writing these kind of instruments could blow up certainly hadn't been appreciated prior to the crisis. So that's the first lesson. That was the role that it played in propagating it. And certainly people became very concerned about the counterparty risk involved in credit default swaps, where, you know, I've said this in a previous speech, you know, a risk hedged is better than a risk not hedged, but it's not the same as a risk not taken. And so I think a lot of people had been, you know, getting some exposure to a particular counterparty and saying, I'm going to lay off that risk by getting a credit default swap from someone else, and forgetting that the someone else was also a risk. And I think that was the real lesson around CDS from the crisis, was that people had to think more carefully about counterparty risk. And actually one of the themes of my talk was about, you know, the concentration of, well, I was talking about industrial production, but it's very true also in the financial system that there were only a few small number of players that had the high enough credit ratings to actually write these kinds of credit default swaps. So yeah, absolutely, it was a huge thing. And so the second part of your question, just remind me, was sort of what lessons we have now in terms of using them. Yeah, just not if that's if I've got that right. Okay, no, you had something a bit different. Oh, what's the activity level? Well,
activity
certainly there, yeah, they're a lot less. Credit default swaps are a lot less used now, and I mean, certainly in Australia, actually, you know, we don't tend to sort of use graphs of CDS spreads in our financial stability review that often because we find it quite hard to interpret. If something, you know, if the CDS spread on Australian banks, for example, moves, is that because people are worried about Australia, or is that because people are worried about the global banks that have written the CDS? And it's very hard to disentangle that. So we tend to just use bond spreads as the signal rather, you know, on the Australian banks rather than looking at CDS as an independent sort of an independent sort of signal of that, because it's very hard to extrapolate that. And so, you know, people have sometimes tried to design various regulatory instruments, or, you know, if your CDS spread goes to here, then your subordinated debt converts to equity or whatever. And people sort of thought about it, but the practical problems with the thinness of the CDS market, I think, has sort of resulted in people not being that keen to actually write those into the rules. But certainly CDS is still used as a hedge. If you've got a certain level of exposure to a firm and you want to keep that relationship, so you don't want to tell them to go away, but you actually wanted a smaller exposure to them, well, then people will use CDS still to lay off some of that risk. But I think people are much more mindful now of the counterparty risk to the person that wrote the CDS. So I think their role will be smaller net-net than it was prior to the crisis, but there'll still be a role for them.
Thank you. Now we have one question there, and then we've got a question in the centre.
Mary Chaseling, Risk Advice Specialist. I just wanted to ask you, how does the Canberra lease, short-term leases on property, differ to the American mortgage process? Because my understanding, and I could be wrong, is that you can purchase short-term leases now, not just the 99-year leases in Canberra, and at any time, if you can't pay it back, you can hand it back. And the four major banks don't want to have anything to do with it, but a lot of the small brokers are, and apparently 17,000 of them were sold last year. So,
well, I'm not an expert in the Canberra housing market particularly. I only ever spent a year there, and I didn't buy a house there. So, you know, we all think we're an expert in housing because we've bought a house at some point. But, I mean, that's an interesting point, but I think what you're getting at is that broader point of when you've got a potential non-recourse loan.
How's it regulated?
Yeah, when you've got a non-recourse loan, does that add to the risk? Well, I mean, 17,000 loans is probably a lot for Canberra, you know, if they all defaulted. But in terms of the overall impact on the financial system, it wouldn't be that big. But there's the broader issue of what it really means to have recourse or non-recourse, and certainly under the state law in across Australia, I'm not an expert in ACT law, but certainly under state law, the difference is people remain personally liable for their debts even if there's been a foreclosure on the house. Whereas in the US, and I was asked this actually at the last speech I did 2 weeks ago, but just to summarise, actually in the US most mortgages are actually recourse. It's not actually that you can mail in the keys directly, but there's only about six states where that's true, where that you can just mail in the keys. But in about half of US states, the foreclosure is a non-judicial process, but then the deficiency judgment is a court process. So a lot of lenders were just saying, well, look, I can get the collateral quickly and I have to go to court for the deficiency. So they just kind of acted as if it was non-recourse, when in fact, as a matter of law, it was a recourse loan. So there may be some wrinkles in Canberra that mean that, as a matter of law, it's non-recourse, but as you mentioned, a lot of lenders the fact that the lenders don't want to touch it is telling you that when you're lending out of your own balance sheet, you have a very different attitude about lending standards than what the US mortgage brokers and mortgage banks had, who were not lending their own balance sheet. They were putting it off into the securitisation machine, and so they didn't really care whether or not the loan defaulted as long as they got their fee at the beginning. So I think that's actually a really good example. If the major banks aren't wanting to touch that specific kind of claim on the property, well, that's sort of telling you the difference between a balance sheet lender and a non-balance sheet lender. Absolutely.
Thank you. Now we have a question in the middle and then we have a question down here.
Hi, my name's David Renneberg from Autism Spectrum Australia. Just like to ask your assessment of Europe at the moment, and I suppose it's just interesting in terms of have they got the political will to avoid another sort of major crisis and falling out?
Well, yeah, I mean, Europe is a whole big political problem. I mean, a large part of the solution there is a matter of the political solution rather than what the central banks or the banking regulators can do. I think, you know, the view of my colleagues have expressed before is, you know, the central banks can do a certain part, the politicians can do a certain part. Neither of them can fix it on their own. They need to work in concert to actually solve the problem. It is soluble, but it has to be a matter of political will. I think, you know, and central bankers are probably not that good at commenting on the politics, so I might just leave it there.
So what would you like to see happen? I mean, what if you were in charge, right? You're the person. What are the steps that you would like to see done?
Okay, well, I mean, I think the important point is that it's very difficult to get a currency union working without fiscal union. So they actually do need some more coherent fiscal union. And if you compare what's happened in Europe with, say, what's happened in the US, in the US, you know, you've got, I mean, a lot of the problems are concentrated in a few states, but, you know, Florida and, you know, pensioners living in Florida are still getting their social security payments. Whereas in Europe, it's not the sort of the European government that doesn't exist, it's fiscal decisions that are making sure that Spanish or Greek pensioners are still getting their payments. It's down to the fiscal position of the governments concerned. You know, Spain in particular I feel a bit sorry for because, you know, they were running quite big surpluses prior to the crisis, but they were growing very fast in a currency union that was growing much more slowly than them. So they had a lot of inflation. You know, they had a huge building boom that's then, you know, a construction boom that's resulted in a big banking system problem for them, which has then become a fiscal problem along with the fact that their economy has become very weak, and that has an impact on your fiscal settings. And so they weren't doing the wrong thing before, except they just had the wrong interest rates for them. And so the way you deal with that, which is the way you deal with it in any diverse economy, is you have to have a fiscal union, and that is a political, you know, a political decision, and it's not an easy one. You know, I can, you know, quite understandably, some of the member countries are quite concerned about giving up their fiscal sovereignty. So it is a very difficult political issue.
Thank you. Lucy, there's a question down here.
Okay.
Hi, my name's Kaveh. I'm from the New South Wales Audit Office. My question has to do with the ratings agencies. And I remember reading a Sydney Morning Herald article well before the GFC, and it pointed out really well all the conflicts of interest and the inherent issues with the system. Now, the regulators have always been quick to deal with crises. Post Enron, you had Sarbanes-Oxley and the auditing profession, Arthur Andersen, they legislated auditing standards. Now you got Basel III. It seems like nothing's been done to the ratings agencies. Am I missing something, or is there something in progress?
Yeah, actually, there is something in progress. In fact, we have to keep writing progress reports about it. So that the conflict of interest inherent in the ratings was indeed one of the things that went wrong in the crisis. You know, unless you wanted me to read out a whole book, I couldn't mention in the talk everything that went wrong. So yeah, absolutely, that was well recognised. And there has been an international program of work under the Financial Stability Board and the International Organisation of Securities Regulators, which is called IOSCO, and both of those international bodies of regulators have been working together to basically encourage the reduction of reliance on credit rating agencies. So, for example, in the US, the Dodd-Frank Act actually says you're not allowed to use ratings at all in anything to do with financial regulation, which is interesting because in the US you actually had ratings embedded even more into their regulatory infrastructure in some elements than some other countries did. And so now the interesting challenge has been, well, what else do you use? And so as long as people aren't using them mechanically, I think people are more comfortable with that. But it's very hard to legislate away their use. And there's probably, I mean, certainly for corporate bonds, and you know, the bonds of a particular entity, corporate or bank bonds, Yeah, having a whole bunch of experts in credit risk giving an opinion that then less sophisticated investors can take on board is a useful thing. It sort of concentrates the expertise. What we saw was that they were mapping from the way they rated bonds to the way they rated complex structures just didn't work. And so that's something that they've really had to roll back on. And there absolutely has been an international regulatory response on that.
And sorry, last question. Has there been anything done to fix the pro-cyclical nature of this? Because now they're making the problem worse.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so the fact that ratings are designed around a kind of a point in time or sort of 1 year ahead default risk, absolutely, that is something that is inherently pro-cyclical because default risk increases when times are bad and goes down when times are good. So I don't think you'll ever, given that's what the ratings agencies are giving an opinion about, I don't think you'll ever completely legislate away that level of pro-cyclicality. But what you may well get, I mean, and what you are seeing in the Basel rules, and you'll probably see in other elements as well, is that even where there's sort of some usage of either probabilities of default or a rating as a proxy for a probability of default, you're using downturn PDs and downturn loss given default. So the way that the Basel rules have evolved in terms of calculating risk weights has been much more about reducing sort of the pro-cyclicality in probabilities of default. Although that said, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about the pro-cyclicality in Basel II, but the work that's been done so far on how pro-cyclical Basel II itself has been suggests that there's maybe not as much pro-cyclicality in there as people had feared. But in principle, yeah, you can have these cliff effects. And so the important thing is to ensure that investors are not just mechanically following a ratings rule. So, you know, this thing has now been downgraded one notch, so I have to dump it all. I mean, investment mandates are actually probably the area where there may well be more work to do globally on reducing the reliance on credit ratings. But I think that problem is pretty well understood internationally.
Great, thanks. We've got time for a couple more questions. Did we have one? We've got one down here and we've got one back there. I'll take that one first and then we'll come down here.
Joanna Heath from the Financial Review. I wondered, do you think the current fiscal consolidation over here?
Sorry, Joanna, I can't actually see where you are.
In the middle, Lucy.
Wave.
Can you see?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, now I can see. So the lights are actually quite bright up here.
Do you think the current fiscal consolidation that's going on at the budgetary level is a necessary or a desirable part of ensuring Australia's financial stability, perhaps to provide a backstop against the next crisis, whether it comes from housing or banking or Europe?
Well, I'm not going to make any statements about current fiscal stance or whatever recent announcements have been going on. I think that's a little bit outside my bailiwick. But what I will say is that, you know, when you've got, you know, almost no government debt, as we did prior to the crisis, and will do, you know, pretty soon again, that's a pretty useful position to be in because it gives you the policy space to respond if something does go wrong, if we are hit by an international shock. So the fact that, you know, a succession of governments had, you know, fiscal surpluses and had a pretty sensible attitude towards fiscal policy in that prior space. This has been recognised by the IMF and many other organisations. I'm not giving a new opinion here, but it's been well recognised that having that kind of an approach to fiscal policy was very useful to us when the crisis did finally hit. I will say, though, I mean, not having that much government debt is also a little bit of a headache in terms of making sure that the banking system can meet the Basel III liquidity rules. So fortunately, that was understood in the Basel Committee, and there's a range of possible options for meeting the liquidity coverage ratio, which include the committed liquidity facility that the Reserve Bank announced in concert with APRA a little while ago. And so, you know, we've got a structure that will allow banks to manage their liquidity prudently, even though there's barely any government debt in Australia, let alone any that's free float not being held by foreigners. So I think, yeah, there was, you know, a minor regulatory headache is a small price to pay for the fact that we then had the policy space at the time. Thanks.
Thanks. Lucy, there's one here.
Dr. Ellis, a question regarding LIBOR and the manipulation.
Greg, can you... It didn't pick up.
Sorry, Greg Collier, CPA Australia. Question regarding LIBOR and the recent discovery of the manipulation that's been going on.
I'm sorry, I can't...
Here.
Dr. Elsa, a question regarding LIBOR and the manipulation that's gone on or recently been discovered or revealed. Do you think we're now getting to the stage where all the bad news, things of that magnitude, the unexploded hand grenades are now out in the open? Or do you think that things like the US fiscal cliff, you know, there's a whole bunch more of fun and games yet to come?
Okay, so the question was, after the LIBOR scandal that's been revealed so far, was there more to come and were there other things coming? There will always be other things coming, whether it's the US fiscal cliff, whether it's any number of sort of political risks. I mean, it's kind of hard. There are a lot of things that you think about as risks, and particularly where there something goes wrong in some other country because of some political issue or something goes wrong with their regulatory infrastructure. It's a little bit rude to put that in your financial stability review, so there are limits to how many of those risks you might choose to mention. But, yeah, obviously events are always the thing that knocks things around, and sometimes it can be very hard to anticipate what the impact of those events might be, and that's in large part the subject of my talk. On the LIBOR issue specifically, my understanding is that there are still investigations going on. I have no inside information into what some of the foreign agencies might be continuing to investigate. I think, you know, there's been a fair... There are also a number of studies going on at the moment, both in the UK and elsewhere, that are making sure that their various interbank sort of benchmark rates are being structured in a way that is has better governance. I think it's well understood that firstly, LIBOR wasn't really used for Australian dollar denominated securities, so we were less affected. And the kind of, you know, the bank bill swap rate, it was designed in a way that was, you know, less susceptible to these things. And I think my colleague Guy DeBell may well have spoken about that publicly in the past. So yeah, I mean, but I would agree with you on the count that there is, you know, on the broader issue of are there things coming down the track, there's bound to be. And maybe we'll have predicted some of them, and maybe some of them will be completely unpredicted. But, you know, that's the way of it, and you'll be blamed both ways. So, thanks.